Welcome to the Conceive Baby podcast. My name's Tasha Jennings, fertility naturopath and nutritionist. In each episode, I share with you my best fertility tips and introduce you to world-leading fertility experts to help you improve your fertility well-being to create your healthy pregnancy. Welcome to today's episode of the Conceive Baby podcast. I'm fertility naturopath and nutritionist Tasha Jennings, and today I'm speaking with the lovely Dr. Tamara Hunter. Dr. Hunter is a gynecologist and CREI certified fertility specialist. Dr. Hunter began her career as an exercise physiologist before attending medical school. Working relentlessly to continually expand her knowledge, Dr. Hunter received two academic prizes for her work in preterm birth and in vitro maturation. And she's become one of the leading fertility specialists in Western Australia and nurtured the vision for an inclusive and evidence-based and holistic women's health hub, WOMB, where she now works with her team. And Tamara has recently also become the medical director of the newly established Monash IVF in WA. Her vision is to offer women the best of both worlds, evidence-based medicine and holistic lifestyle support. And today, Dr. Hunter will be sharing her insights into a topic that, look, seems to be gaining in prevalence and awareness. I know it's something I'm certainly receiving more referrals for. And ESHRE, which is the European Society of Human Reproduction and Embryology, recently updated their guidelines relating to this topic, and that's recurrent implantation failure. So today we'll be discussing those guidelines as well as proactive steps that you can take to help to overcome recurrent implantation failure and create a successful, healthy pregnancy. So welcome, Tamara.
Hi, Tasha. Thanks so much for having me.
Now, thank you so much for taking the time out of what I know is a super busy schedule. But let's first of all start a little bit about your journey. How did you get into the world of fertility? I find everyone has a story around it.
Yeah. So I went to medical school late. I actually did, as you said, exercise physiology first. I worked for a couple of years, but I'd always wanted to become a doctor. So I returned to medical school when I was 25. After completing medical school, University of Sydney, I then moved back home to Western Australia. It's what a lot of young people do, is they eventually move back home. And I worked as a resident for one year, but I was very inspired while I was at medical school to do obstetrics and gynecology. And I actually wanted to become an obstetrician and deliver all the babies in Perth. But I got through to my third year of training in ONG and I was just completely burned out, doing lots of night shift, being involved in some really complicated births, really got me rethinking what it was that I wanted to do. And I was really inspired by the lifestyle choice in doing reproductive medicine, but also just the potential for learning about things that I really didn't know much about. So I elected to do the certificate in reproductive endocrinology and infertility, which is an additional 3 years on top of ONG training. But in actual fact, it took me five because I had a couple of babies in there as well.
Wow, that was a lot.
Yeah, it was. So I got my subspecialty training and I've worked in this field ever since.
Okay, it looks lovely field, and I find everyone has a story to get into it. And I love helping people have babies and seeing that fruition. And so you've also had a journey yourself in the medical sphere, from obviously the other side. So yeah. Can you just tell us a little bit about that to start off with?
Yeah, so I guess COVID has been a big thing for many people, and as many women did during COVID, they kind of put off their screening tests. Being in my sort of mid to late 40s, I won't tell you exactly how old I am, but mid to late 40s, That routine mammogram that I probably should have done during COVID, I kind of just put off. And then earlier this year, I had a patient come to me for fertility preservation, given that she was about to commence chemotherapy for breast cancer. And it just got me thinking, I really need to do that screening test. So I went and got my routine mammogram done. And unbeknownst to me, I had a invasive ductal carcinoma. So I was pretty lucky. I had an amazing team around me. I had chemotherapy earlier this year, followed by surgery, which actually showed that the chemo had completely treated the breast cancer. I had no evidence of disease in my lymph node. And then I had a preventative radiation therapy after that, which I finished, would be about 6 weeks ago now. And now just trying to get on with my life.
And more than getting on with your life, you've now become the medical director of the newly established Monash IVF. So thank you for taking the time to be with us and obviously share your journey to help others in the fertility space. But also I think that awareness around testing is really important, whether it's in the fertility sphere or not. So today we're delving into the world of recurrent implantation failure, which I don't know about you, but I am, whether it's becoming more prevalent or there's more awareness around it, the chicken and an egg, but I'm seeing more issues with that implantation failure. So for anyone listening today who's not sure what that is, can we just describe what recurrent implantation failure is?
Yeah, so it really is about definitions in this space. And I guess the first thing I want to say is recurrent pregnancy loss and recurrent implantation failure are very different things. So obviously recurrent miscarriage is what people think about when they fall pregnant, either spontaneously or through assisted reproduction. They have a positive pregnancy test and then perhaps a scan, and then unfortunately either there's fetal demise or they spontaneously miscarry the pregnancy. So that's recurrent pregnancy loss. Recurrent implantation failure is essentially where, you can only really define it in the space of having IVF, but it's where someone has had some good quality embryos transferred into the uterus as part of an IVF cycle, and they have not fallen pregnant. Yep. So I guess the biggest difficulty in definition is, well, how do we define good quality embryos? And that's been part of the debate for I don't know how long. Are we defining embryos by how they look morphologically under the microscope? Are we using patient factors to define them? For example, a young patient should have good quality embryos because they are young. Or are we using invasive tests such as genetic testing of embryos to determine whether an embryo is euploid, i.e. normal chromosomes, or if it's aneuploid, so either too many or not enough chromosomes? So that has always been our problem, and I think that's the fundamental issue that we have with all of the research and all of the guidelines around recurrent implantation failure is, well, how do we describe what is a good quality embryo?
And you're right, it is only in the context of IVF that we can even, I guess, diagnose, if we can even diagnose this condition, because we would be unaware in a natural pregnancy. So obviously it's become more of a recognized issue, and perhaps, you know, a few years ago it wasn't as recognized, and now the ESHRE guidelines actually now have, you know, created guidelines around this topic and updated their guidelines to include that recurrent implantation failure. I guess, can you give us a bit of an overview of their recommendations in regards to what aspects they've included for diagnosis?
Yeah, so I think the first thing is they have attempted to come up with a definition of recurrent implantation failure that is a little bit more inclusive of different population types. So I really liked the way that they have said, look, it's the scenario where you transfer embryos that are considered to be viable, so good quality, but that has failed to result in a positive pregnancy test. And enough embryos have been transferred in an individual patient to warrant consideration of further investigations as to why they're not falling pregnant. So I like the fact that it could be two. It could be two PGT-tested embryos. It could be three morphologically normal embryos. It could be four in someone maybe who has severe endometriosis. So they've kind of tried to make it a little bit more individualized, such that a clinician can just, I guess, what I call raise their bunny ears and go, I would have expected this patient to be pregnant by now. Why is this not happening? So I think I like the way they've kind of reformed their thinking from that definition point of view. When looking at some of the more specific factors involved in why is this person not pregnant, they've really started to drill down into endometrial receptivity. I do think that that is something that has been very trendy and very popular to investigate over the last decade. And so they've looked further into, is endometrial receptivity a thing, and do we have robust tests for that, including assessment of the microbiome. I'm very interested in the microbiome and where the research on that is heading. They've also drilled into the recent research around, is someone's progesterone level important? I do think that the consensus is coming around to, yeah, it probably is gaining importance as to what that progesterone level is like at the time we're putting the embryo back in the uterus. And then also they've looked a bit more into those thrombophilia tests.
Yep.
And whether we should be giving things like clexane, low molecular weight heparin, aspirin, who should we be giving them to and why? Unfortunately, I think there is still a lot of watch this space in the immunological space. And I think that comes down to the quality of research and the numbers in the research studies. I really also like the way in the recent guidelines they've kind of used the traffic light system, and they've used that in other aspects of, in other guidelines. ESHRE have used the traffic light, sort of green for go, amber for consider but personalize it, and red for perhaps you really shouldn't make this recommendation. But there's always the caveat, and again, I like the fact that they've appreciated that when you're doing research, you include people into a research study under certain criteria. So therefore, that would be the usual patient that you'd be making a recommendation around treating or not treating. But they've recognized that some people don't fit that box. So even with the traffic light red do not recommend, there may be some populations in which these treatments or investigations may be considered because those people just don't meet the criteria for the studies. Yeah. So I think it is allowing clinicians to think a bit more broadly, but in the same essence, they're saying, hey, certain things have really robust evidence and they're the only ones you should be considering as green. Red areas, there's probably not great evidence, so we can't completely say do not do this.
Yeah. I do love in the way they've written the guidelines that a lot of it ends, watch this space almost. It's like further research needed, further research needed. And we know it is coming. So as you said, it's a stop for now. It's a, we don't know enough about this space. We don't have the research there to validate it and strongly recommend it. But a lot of it was left with a to be continued almost, I felt when reading it through, that we are waiting on those recommendations. So given that it is a space where there are lots of things open, there are lots of green, there was lots of amber, there were lots of red, and there was lots of patients asking about the red, and you probably find that as well in your patients. You know, there is a lot of things that people are seeing, whether it's on Facebook forums and things like that. We've got natural killer cells, we've got DQ alpha, there's obviously the microbiome, which obviously I'm passionate about as well. I just did a presentation on that last week, actually, which is obviously a really growing field of research. But can you delve into some of those things that perhaps people are asking their specialist about?
Yeah. So if we, and I've gotten a little list of the red ones because I can't remember all of them, but I can just go through each of them. So vitamin D testing biologically seems plausible because there are vitamin D receptors in the endometrium. And we do know that it is important for adherence of the embryo to the lining. And look, many women are vitamin D deficient. However, the research studies, some have said, yep, supplementing with vitamin D is important. And some of the research has said, actually, it doesn't seem to improve pregnancy or live birth outcomes. So it is one of those things, however, that I think is relatively harmless, vitamin D. It's fairly easy to do, though in Australia it's not on the MBS anymore. So it is a test that patients will have to pay for. However, it's relatively easy to test for, and it's relatively harmless to supplement in vitamin D, or at least suggest that using appropriate precautions, getting some vitamin D exposure is easy to do. So I although it says not recommended, I think it's relatively benign. As far as endometrial receptivity goes, because I know that, and I'll just call out the ERA test, because it's the most common one. So we've got the ERA, which is assessing the genomics of the lining. There's the EMMA, which is assessing the genomics of the microbiome. And then you've got the ALICE, which is assessing chronic endometritis, knowing that a large amount of bugs can't be cultured for. So looking at the genetic pathological bugs. So again, there seems to have been an increase in research into the ERA. There are lots of other tests that assess endometrial receptivity as well that probably haven't been researched in as robust a fashion. But the current data seems to suggest that the ERA probably doesn't make a significant difference with regards to pregnancy rates and live birth rates. And there was actually quite an elegant reanalysis of a large randomized controlled trial that says if you move the day of transfer according to the ERA results, you may actually cause more harm. In other words, a pregnancy rate. So I am a little cautious around doing personalized embryo transfers using ERA. I really can't comment on the other tests that are out there because I think they lack the robust studies.
Yeah.
It biologically sounds really plausible, but that perhaps the window of implantation could be different for some women. With regards to the microbiome, with regards to chronic endometritis, we do think chronic endometritis is something that you could assess on hysteroscopy or even looking at the microbiology and the histology of the endometrium and treat it with antibiotics. And again, relatively harmless. And the microbiome, well, I guess the thing about the microbiome is we don't really know what a normal microbiome should be at the time of the implantation. We think lactobacillus is really important. And so my feeling on this is just, there's no harm in supplementing.
And
I would always refer to a naturopath. I feel naturopaths probably understand the microbiome things a little better than fertility specialists. And if a patient has time and is prepared to do some work on the microbiome, then I don't see that it's necessarily a bad thing, as long as it doesn't take them away from treatment for sort of 6 to 12 months and potentially they age out of the ability to get good embryos for transfer.
So, I love working with fertility specialists on that because I think that's where antibiotics can come into play. And I'm often, patients are surprised, why are you referring me for antibiotics? I'm like, because they're going to speed the process. They're going to kill off the bad bugs. We can recolonize the good stuff and we can get the whole thing happening quicker for you.
What else is really important? Progesterone, I think, is really important. I am an avid supporter of getting a progesterone level on the day of transfer. I do think there are variations in uptake through the vaginal mucosa, given that vaginal pessaries is the mainstay of giving micronized progesterone to patients. There are some patients that just don't absorb it. So being able to get on top of that on the day of transfer, whether or not you do a progesterone level in the late follicular phase, I I don't necessarily think that it's important, but I do think that that mid-luteal progesterone is important. A lot of the work by Elena Labata has suggested that, really good quality studies. So I do think that that is something worth considering. What about the immunological stuff? So this is a little bit of a cauldron.
Absolutely. And we spoke off air about this. I'm like, do we even go there? Because this is a whole topic on its own. But yeah, just love your insights.
This is the stuff that people will go onto Google for.
Yeah.
It is the stuff that is a little bit out of mainstream. So I hark back to that comment I made before that perhaps there are populations of people that could be considered for this, but it's a very small pinnacle of people that might have had, I don't know, 7, 8, 9, 10 embryos transferred. It wouldn't be the population of people where they've had 2, 3 embryos transferred, and I'd be going down this pathway. I can definitely tell you that. But the main one that people bring up with me is natural killer cells, specifically the uterine natural killer cells. Yeah. And they are supposed to be abundant in the endometrium in that window of the implantation. Particularly the ones that we study are the CD56 positive uterine natural killer cells. So the current data says, or the current guidelines suggest, that we don't go investigating these. And here's my take on it. Peripheral natural killer cells and uterine natural killer cells are completely different things.
Yep.
And I don't think that one reflects the other. So I definitely don't recommend getting a blood test to assess your natural killer cells. That's the first thing. The second thing is, if you are assessing the uterine natural killer cells, they should be assessed in a natural cycle, completely distant to doing any embryo transfers. The current data suggests that they may or may not be associated with recurrent implantation failure. If they are significantly abnormal and you're treating with prednisolone, again, the data, some data supports that it helps and some data supports suggests that it doesn't. The big randomized control trial hasn't been done.
Yeah.
We're asking for it to be done. But I think now it's just made its way into practice, routinely giving people prednisolone, that randomized trial probably won't ever be done, which is a shame.
But I'd love for it to be. I would just had the discussion with a patient this morning about this, who is being prescribed it relatively routinely. And I did a podcast episode actually with Professor Sarah Robertson from SA, and this is her jam. Like, she's like right into receptivity and the immunology, and she spoke about NK cells and immunology. So if you're more interested in than we can discuss today, jump onto that episode with Professor Sarah Robertson. That was fertility and the immune system. But yeah, it's really found its way into, I think, probably from patients, you know, Googling, as you said.
Yeah. And again, a lot of practitioners don't put in the time. So they don't do the test and then do the treatment and then see that the treatment has made a benefit. They'll just give prednisolone in the next cycle. And I feel like that's not doing the right service to the patient, because the theory or the thinking is that prednisolone is relatively benign, but it's not a benign drug.
Yeah.
It's a corticosteroid. It changes glucose profiles. It can, you know, in someone who has a predisposition to insulin resistance, it can change their glucose profile leading into pregnancy, which can affect placentation itself and affect pregnancy outcomes. So I do think that this is a drug that we need to be mindful of before we just start throwing it around like Smarties.
Yeah. I think that's good advice around that one. And that's probably something that I get asked a lot about you, but I get asked a lot about those, the immune protocols and how to support that implantation failure. Now, how are we going through the list? Are we, there more red ones there?
Yeah. Look, they're all red.
Yeah.
Lot of it is that the evidence just isn't there for your HLA compatibility, your cytokine testing, your T lymphocytes. It's all been looked at in research, but unfortunately either the research is in equipoise, it can't decide, or the evidence just hasn't looked at the outcomes that we're most interested in with any great power. So I think at this point, because the treatments are immunological, they do have effect. They can potentially have long-term effect, and we don't know those outcomes. At the moment, I think we shouldn't be going down that pathway in the majority of patients.
I love your personalization approach. And that's what I know with my patients. I go way back to their mother's pregnancy because that's when their eggs were developed. And I go all the way through their history until now because I want to, you know the life their eggs have lived to properly help them with their egg quality and support that implantation. I think that comes down to their IVF treatment as well. Like, what is it for them that is going to make the biggest difference? Now, we touched on it a little bit before, and that's PGT testing, I guess, of embryos, because as you said, it's not necessarily a beauty contest. We can look at their morphology, but, you know, how do we know if these embryos are viable? How does the testing relate to recurrent implantation failure?
Yeah. So where do I start with this?
Yeah, we're really digging ourselves a hole here. It's a big topic.
So PGT for aneuploidy testing, so we're looking at abnormal number of chromosomes, does have its place. And I think that's why I think that they have included it in the AMBER group guidelines. Where I think it's of great value in a recurrent implantation failure patient is to help them make a decision about ending treatment, in all honesty. So if I'm testing embryos, I would want to be testing 4, 5, 6 embryos at once so that I can show them that a significantly high number of their embryos are chromosomally abnormal, perhaps all of them, so that I can then turn around to them and say, I think you should stop with autologous IVF using your own eggs. I think that's actually its greatest value in this space. Yes, the data, some supports overcoming recurrent implantation failure. Some says that it doesn't overcome or improve pregnancy and live birth rates. But what it definitely does is reduce the time to an ongoing pregnancy. So if the studies looked at cumulative pregnancy rates or cumulative live birth rates, I think the outcomes would be different. But instead, they're looking at absolute rates, and therefore they're saying, well, there's no difference if you use a tested versus an untested embryo.
Yeah.
So, but cumulatively, it will reduce the time to an ongoing pregnancy test. And as I said, I think its greatest value is in telling people to stop treatment.
I've also had a lot of people use it in regards to miscarriage. They can't go through that again. They want to make sure the next embryo that they put back in is
chromosomally normal.
Yeah, is a good one and has every chance of, becoming better.
And so, it does enable clinicians, sorry to interrupt, but it does enable clinicians to say, because recurrent implantation failure is largely a diagnosis of exclusion.
Yeah.
So it does enable clinicians to take something off the table. Okay, we're putting back a chromosomally normal embryo. Yes, we haven't overcome transfer issues, but we can start to hone down and personalize what it is that's actually going on with you.
Because it is a hard, and I think the whole fertility field really is, it's not always black and white. There's not like, yes, this is the answer, and this is no, this is the answer. And the difficulty is I often have patients that are given the option, would you like to do the immune protocol, or maybe you could not? And that's really hard, because then we're telling them not to Google, and that's exactly what they have to do to be able to make a decision. So there isn't a black and white on this. I think it's a matter of speaking with your specialist and getting the diagnosis that you need and the testing that you need. So I guess, what are some questions that hopefully, look, come and see you is a really good start. But what are some questions for people who are seeing their specialist who are perhaps thinking that this may be an issue for them? What should they be speaking with their specialist about and asking their specialist?
Well, I do think that sometimes we get on, I'll call it the roller coaster, of just continuing to put embryos back and sort of tweaking little things. So I definitely think that patient should advocate for themselves and say, hey, you know, you put back 3 embryos that the embryologist said were normal or pretty good for me. Am I a candidate for investigation for recurrent implantation failure? I think that's one of the greatest things the patients can do, is advocate for themselves in that space. Otherwise, they're going to be sort of 12 months down the track, 4 to 6 embryos transferred, and they're just continuing on. So I think advocacy itself is really important. Mostly in an IVF space, and I'll say mostly because I can't speak for everyone, but mostly in an IVF space, the basic tests have been done. But I think it's, again, it's up, a patient can very easily say, you know, have you done all of my tests for, you know, chromosomes or thrombophilias, you know, the basics of the thyroid function, the prolactin test, have you done a good 3D ultrasound to show I don't have submucosal fibroids, or, you know, again, advocating that all those basic tests have been done. And then going back to just the review of the treatment so far. So I think there are some really important things that a patient can do to sort of have what I call the clinician raise the bunny ears and go, is this something I've missed here? Is this something else that I need to go and investigate?
I think that's quite empowering for the patient too, to actually often get them talk through their results and what they mean. And because there is often they get ticked, everything's normal. I'm like, well, what does that mean? Can I have a look at things? And sometimes I love to look at like thyroid. Is it optimal or is it just okay? You know, and in regards to their microbiome, I often, you know, if they have had recurrent thrush or recurrent VV and things like that, and we can pick that up and treat that and improve that, then that may be helpful for that person. But it depends on the specialist. And also, I think empowering yourself to just say it doesn't feel right. If it doesn't feel right, just flag that, get their answer. And at least, as you said, you've put that on the radar that there is something further to be investigated. Now, I guess in regards to empowering patients, is there anything they can do from a lifestyle perspective, in your opinion, to help improve their outcomes in recurrent implantation failure?
Yeah. So most people that would come and see someone like you is already onto it. That's what I think. Is a lot of people that ask me the question, what can I do? They're already doing most things.
Yeah.
I do love in the guidelines how they have flagged optimization of lifestyle factors in both men and women. Remember, men is really
great. Yes.
So I do like how that they have flagged that as a green. So for it. BMI, definitely.
Yeah.
So, you know, we see weight as pathological now in the context of egg health and sperm health.
Yep.
I do think that a woman with obesity or a man with obesity do need to look at addressing that, because unless you have good gamete health, you're not going to have good embryo health.
Yep.
We find it very difficult to measure that in an embryo. We can't see the little organelles and how they're working. So I do think that optimization of BMI is key. I think it's important. And then there's the obvious things like smoking and alcohol consumption. Mm-hmm. They're lay down misère. Those things are hugely important for both men and women to consider. So lifestyle factors are hugely important. And I think patients can be really empowered by embracing those things.
I love that you said men and women. I did a podcast episode where I refer all my patients to with Associate Professor Adam Watkins, whose his research is into the impact of preconception health. And it's showing that, yes, it infects sperm health, it affects conception, but it also affects the health of the pregnancy and miscarriage rates and the lifelong health of your future child. So I'm always like, don't take it from me, take it from another guy who is a professor, young professor, and it really makes a difference to the whole outcome of that reproductive cycle, not just getting them pregnant. But yes, in the context of recurrent implantation failure, I think there is a presumption for the men in some cases that I've done my job, I've got the embryo, they're falling down, and that's not the case. That takes two to tango the whole way through this process.
That's right. Absolutely.
So look, thank you for taking the time to explore these guidelines and give us your insights into that, which I think has been so helpful to a lot of people, and hopefully stop that global rabbit warren for a few people. So I guess looking ahead, how do you see, I guess, this the guidelines affecting the landscape and the evolving research in the coming years? Is there anything of potential breakthroughs we hope on the horizon?
Well, as with any guideline, they always ask for more research. I think you said that before.
Yep.
particularly within the realms of, say, vitamin D and the immunological stuff, the endometrial activity tests, all the work being done around genomics. I do think we are knocking on the door of non-invasive assessments of embryos, and I do think that will be really important, although we know that biopsying day five or blastocyst embryos does little harm, there is still that question of maybe it's not perfect. And so looking at the metabolites of those embryos and those non-invasive assessments of embryos as an alternative, I think is imminently on the horizon. The areas that we will continue to struggle with is treatment of the thin endometrium. Has identified sort of immunological factors or adjuvant treatments that we can really treat the thin endometrium well with. So I think we're still on that pathway. But, you know, more research in all of these areas is required.
And look, hopefully it will. I do think it is. You know, the research is coming through. And as I said, all the guidelines, a lot of the reds, when I first saw it, all these reds, I'm like, oh, you know, we've got no hope of these new things coming through. But when you delve into the actual guidelines, there is, yes, we see the literature, it's not conclusive. We need more research, need more research, need more research. So I think it's a good start and a great help to people who are struggling with this topic. And hopefully we've helped a few people, empower them with what they can do, because you can feel a little bit out of control in this situation. So lots of things you can do to support your own journey.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, thank you so much, as I said, for taking the time out of your super busy schedule to join us today. And I think we'll probably need to have you back to talk about the little rabbit warrens that we left open here for future times.
Sure, there'll be lots of questions, Tasha.
Great. Well, thanks very much. I look forward to joining you soon.
Pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Conceive Baby podcast. To help you move forward on your journey to pregnancy, I've created your free fertility checklist for you. This checklist provides simple swaps you can make that can have a significant impact on your chances of conceiving and carrying your healthy baby. So be sure to head to conceivebaby.com.au/checklist to download your free fertility checklist today.